My name is Kathy, and I'm an alcoholic addict. So everybody was asking me if I was nervous, and now I feel a little nervous because I'm at this podium and I'm being taped. So my sobriety date is January 29th, 2000, so I have a significant amount of clean time. I identify as an addict, alcoholic, and so I think where I'm going to start out is I like to start with step one, powerlessness and unmanageability. And so I'll talk a little bit about my childhood and how I was raised and how that relates to that. And so I was raised in an environment where I experienced lots of powerlessness and lots of unmanageability. I was born into addiction. My father was an addict. We lived in Oakland. The first four children were born in Oakland. And we lived in poverty. And so there was eight of us growing up as a kid. And we were very, very poor, not just poor. But we were poor. Like, we didn't have blankets, we didn't have sheets, we didn't have towels. We lived off government food and food stamps and tortillas and beans, and that's what we lived, and cornflakes, right? And potatoes, we grew potatoes. And so there was also a lot of violence and a lot of drug addiction and just a lot of dysfunction. And so when I first came into the rooms and I heard of powerlessness and unmanageability around substance use, I didn't really want to relate to that. I believed that it was a choice and that I chose to live the way that I was living. And so I wasn't one of these addicts that woke up the next day and said, "Oh God, I'm going to quit using today. Like, I'm sick of this and I'm going to quit using today." And that wasn't how I used. And so I used to say that I started using drugs when I was seven, but the truth is I was being given drugs when I was seven. And so as a child and experiencing that powerlessness and unmanageability and being given drugs and that kind of thing, and there was a lot of sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, and like I said, poverty. And so so basically my thoughts as a child is I remember being 9 years old and thinking, like, I want to be the drug dealer. Like, I want to be the person where my dad is going to and giving his money to, because they have soap and they have towels and they have pretty stuff in their house. And I remember just going into the bathroom and, like, being so amazed that they had these beautiful, like, little glycerin soaps. And I don't know if people know what those are, but they were very colorful, really smelled so good. And I just remember being in the bathroom, like, smelling these soaps and really wishing, like, I wanted to live this way. And so I was also a fighter as a kid. I was the brawler in the family. And there was eight of us growing up, like I said. And so because we were poor, when I went to school, we were often made fun of because we had lice, we had scabies. You know, we were Mexican, and back then I looked Mexican. I know now I don't look Mexican, but back then when I was a kid, it was very obvious that we were the Mexican family in the town and we were very poor. And so I would often get into fights at school, and so I was always in trouble, always being sent to the office, and I would refuse, and they would carry me down there, and I would just fight and kick and scream. And but what I don't remember is anybody ever saying, like, what's going on at home? Why are you acting this way? You know, and so I spent a lot of time in the office. I spent a lot of time suspended, a lot of time in trouble. They sent me to, like, special ed classes to try to figure out, you know, what's wrong with this child? Like, why is she doing this? And really, there was so much abuse going on at home that I really felt like people really turned a blind eye to that, because, of course, that was in the 60s. So I was born in the 60s, mind you. So if you can imagine being born in the 60s and living in Oakland, and my dad ran with the Black Panthers, and, you know, he just was really involved heavily in that lifestyle. And my mother was a Jehovah's Witness. And so my mother was raised a Catholic, and then she became a Jehovah's Witness when she was 14 years old. And so growing up in our house, we didn't have any holidays. When we were at school and a holiday party came, we had to go to the office. We weren't allowed to do the Pledge of Allegiance. We didn't have birthday parties. We didn't have any of that stuff growing up as a kid. And so our life was really pretty, pretty sad, really, to tell you the truth about it. And so I was being given drugs when I was young, and I started using drugs on my own when I was probably about nine. I started smoking pot and by the time I was 11, I was doing meth, and I had tried coke, and I had tried sniffing paint, and had tried using alcohol. And I knew, like, I was the kind of person, like, I remember my first drunk. I was 13 years old, and I drank Mad Dog 2020. I'm sure people know what that is.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was my first drunk, was drinking Mad Dog 2020. And you think that any normal person would wake up the next day and say, I'm not going to do that again, right? But that wasn't my story. Like, I woke up the next day, I blacked out, I woke up in a strange place with an older man that was 19 years old, and I was 13, and I did it again. Right? That was the start of me starting to put substances in my body. And I already had learned at a young age that you can change the way you feel by putting a substance in your body. Like, I learned that really, really young. And so, needless to say, that was my story throughout my whole life. I left home when I was 16. I took off with a bunch of bikers, and I had no business being with these people. They were, ex-convicts and 40-year-old men, and I was 16 years old, and I really had no business being with these people. But I managed to graduate high school early through continuation school with them. And so I took off when I was 17, and I moved to Reading with all these bikers. And by the time I was already doing meth by then, and drinking. I was doing everything. Like, I was the garbage can. The only thing I wasn't doing was opiates. And so... anyway, so when you look at powerlessness and unmanageability, I had lived my whole life that way. And in my mind, it wasn't unmanageable because it was better than the life that my dad provided me, right? And I had a house, and I had towels, and I had sheets, and I had food in my refrigerator, and I had all those things. And so that was my comparison. And so when I say, like, I never woke up and said, God, I want to quit using, I want to change my life, I just knew from a young age that this is my life. Like, this is the way that I'm going to live. I don't have any other choices. I'm not going to be able to get an education because I can't afford it. I'm not going to be able to travel because I can't afford that either. And so I never aspired to have any of those things. And so so I'm going to go fast forward. So that life was, domestic violence, drug abuse, selling drugs, getting a house, having a house, ending up in a violent situation, leaving that house, and that was my life. And so I got pregnant with my daughter when I was 28, and I got married to another drug dealer who went to prison, and I used while I was pregnant. And so I'm going to fast forward to my second child. And so my second child, and so as you know, this disease is progressive. Like, it gets worse, it doesn't get better. And that's what happened with me, is things slowly got worse and worse and worse. But still, there wasn't a part of me that wanted to really, like, change the situation until I was pregnant with my son. And so when I got pregnant with my son, I had decided I'm not going to... I had no prenatal care. I used through my entire pregnancy, and I was homeless. That's where my addiction had taken me, and I had, switched methods, and I gave birth to this child of mine, my son. And what I want to say is that I had every intention of leaving him at the hospital. Like, I gave birth to him, and I knew that I had no way to provide for this child. And my intention was to leave him at the hospital. And I was getting high at the hospital after I gave birth. And I went up there. He was in the NICU for 7 days, I think. And I went up to the NICU basically to kind of say goodbye to him. And this always kind of brings a little bit of tears to my eyes, because when I went to the NICU, the nurses were very mean to me. They were, like, very judgmental, and, like, they were giving me dirty looks, and my son's on oxygen, and he's got this thing over him, and he's crying, and he won't eat, and he's going through withdrawal. And I said something to him, and he stopped. Like, he stopped fussing. And so I said to them, let me hold him. And they said, well, you can't nurse him. You can't nurse him because you're still not clean. And so I took him in my arms, and I held him for the first time. And I realized in that moment that I loved him, and that this baby still loved me, even though I had just drug him through hell, And he stopped crying, and he let me comfort him. And that was my first treatment attempt. So I called my mom, and I said, look, Mom, I just gave birth, and he's tox positive, and they're wanting to take him, and they're offering me to go into treatment. So I went into treatment. He joined me 5 days later when he got out of the NICU, and I left treatment 3 weeks later, and I went back out, and I started using again, and I took him with me. And then I came back in again 6 months later, and this is where I kind of like to start my process of recovery, because I really thought that the 12-step fellowship was a cult. Like, I thought, if you guys use like me, then you would not be here being happy and joyous and free. Like, you know, you must have not used the way that I did, because I was not feeling happy and joyous and free, and I didn't know how to live any other way than I had been living. And so basically what I did when I went into treatment is I sold cigarettes like they were drugs. I took people hostage. I was mean. And I was not a very nice person when I got clean. I was very brash and loud. And I wouldn't say physically violent, but definitely violent with my words. And basically what I did was whatever I wanted in the treatment program, I broke every rule that there was. I laughed. And I thought, I'm not going to get loaded over smoking a cigarette. Like, you guys are full of it. You know, and I still did not believe in the 12-step fellowship. And so needless to say, I stayed clean for 5 months, and I got loaded at 5 months. I collected my 6-month chip like I was clean, and then I disappeared again. And so I took my kid and I disappeared. I got kicked out of a halfway house that I was living in, and I took my kid with me and left, and I went back to the streets and started using again. And that last 6 months. So what they say is if you get some recovery under your belt, it messes up your using. And so that's exactly what it did, right? Is that I knew that there was a different way to live. And so that was when my first time that I ever remembering, like, I don't want to do this. Like if fentanyl had been around then, my kid probably would be dead, because he was in my addiction in a room with a bunch of people. And he would have been the child that would have overdosed on fentanyl, like we see other children happening to. And so when I came back that third time into treatment, with my first admission was step one, where I really realized, like, oh, my God, like, I did a 65-page autobiography. And in that 65-page autobiography that took me a week to read, was the years and years and years and years of unmanageability and powerlessness. And when I looked at that on paper, I want to say that I began to grieve. Like, I was just could not stop crying. And I think I cried for 2 months because the realization of really looking at the impact of my entire life, like, I really hadn't even admitted some of the things that went on in my childhood. And so that admission and beginning to look at that was really, really hard. And it was full of grief. And so everybody would say things like, well, everything happens for a reason. And I'd be like, yeah, let me step on your toes. So what's the reason that that happened? Do you think it happened because I did it? Or do you think that God had a hand in that? And so I was still very, very bitter, right? And I did not believe in God. I grew up with a Jehovah's Witness God, and bless your heart if you're a Jehovah's Witness and you're in this room, and I'm sorry, because my experience was not healthy. Like, the church sent my mom back to my father every time she tried to leave him. You know, he would go to the church and say, you know, I really want to work this out with my wife, and they would force her to go back to my father. And so, you know, after the admission of step one and really looking at that powerless and unmanageability and really getting it, that as long as I don't put a drug in my body, that I don't have to experience that powerlessness anymore, right? And so when I was in treatment, and I like to share this story because it's so simple, right? We were allowed to have like one cookie at the meeting. And they would tell us, like, when you guys go as a 25 group of people and everybody eats one cookie, that's 25 cookies. There's not much cookies left for everybody else, right? And I would just be like, I'm going to eat as many cookies as I want. Like, I don't care what you guys say, you know? And what happened for me is that that term, half measures availed us nothing, and we stood at that turning point. And for me, it was about really deciding, like, do I want to be honest or do I want to continue in the behavior that I was doing? And so I made a shift in my thinking, and I began to tell on myself. And I began to say, hey, I would raise my hand. I ate two cookies or three cookies at the meeting, and people just really thought that I was stupid. But really what I was trying to do was get to that place of humility. And I really finally got the concept of one is too many and 1,000 is never enough behind cookies. Like, I finally began to realize, and my sponsor said to me, like, have you ever thought that maybe you shouldn't eat that one cookie? And I said, well, actually, I never really thought about that. She says, well, I want you to try it. Like, I want you to go to the meeting and I don't want you to have any cookies. And so that was my first application of the one is too many and a thousand is never enough. And I know that it sounds silly, but that's really where it started at. And then my sponsor took me into step two, right? And so for me, I could not get past the God thing. Like I am atheist, by the way, but I have some beliefs that I practice vigilantly. And so she had me write in my journal every single day for 4 months asking for that obsession to be lifted. And so I did that because that's what she suggested. And I was trying to follow every suggestion that she gave me. And so I did that. And then I did step three and she had me do a 4-step on my God. And I don't know, I've never heard of anybody else doing that, but she had me do a 4-step on my God. And she had me create this vision of if I had a higher power, what that higher power would look like, you know, and what strengths and what values would that higher power have. And so that was my third step. And, you know, from my 4-step, looking at all my resentments and looking at my character. So from my 4-step, I was able to pull off all my character defects, all the people that I owed amends from, you know, it was just this intense 4-step. And so, and as a result of that 4-step, I was able to do the other steps, right? And I had found, so by the way, I used with all of my family members. So we all used together and we all became addicts except for one out of the 8 of us. And so I had to distance myself from my family because I knew that I could not stay clean and be around my family. But what happened was people started following suit, you know? And so, you know, working the steps really has given me like a map to live. And it really gave me, like when I got here, I didn't even know how to say please and thank you, right? I didn't know how to dress. I dressed like I was like a hooker. And I was 35 years old and I was walking around like half undressed. And so what I will say is that from treatment, I decided to become a substance abuse counselor. And so I went to school. I knew if I didn't find a way to support myself that I would go back to selling drugs because that's what I knew how to do. And so I went to school and I became a counselor. And I like to share this experience is that I would often walk through the grass, right? And I would be in high heels and my feet would sink in the mud and I would get mad because now I've got mud on my heels. And I just remember this moment of clarity where I looked up and I realized that everybody else was walking on the sidewalk. And then as a result of taking a shortcut, I was getting muddy and dirty. And so from that moment on, I quit walking through the grass and I quit walking through the mud and I started walking on the sidewalk. You know, and I learned how to be a woman here. Like I met some amazing women and they showed me how to be a woman and they showed me how to dress so that people would treat me respectfully. And what I want to say is my first year of my sobriety, I went to this meeting because there was lots of motorcycles there and lots of guys with tattoos, right? And that was how I knew how to relate to people. And so I went to that meeting faithfully for 18 months every single day. I lived in a halfway house for 18 months and I really connected with some amazing women in that program. And we helped each other and we cooked together. We babysit each other's children. We helped each other with our homework. You know, we were just three people in recovery trying to learn how to be parents and how to learn how to live a normal life. And so I'm so grateful that I had those women in my life. And, you know, so doing my character defects, that was another really hard one for me because really the character defects that I had, I really felt like they were survival skills. And that without those skills, like I didn't know what else to do. And so, but what I learned is that there's an opposite side, right? There's an opposite side. Like I wasn't like walking around lying to people, but what I did do was I didn't tell them anything about me because I figured the more that you knew about me, the more you had over my head. And that was how I grew up. Like you don't tell anybody anything because then they've got something on you. And so that's how I lived my life. And so looking at my character defects, and I heard something at a meeting the other night where he said, it's not that our character defects go away, it's that we put them up on a shelf. And then sometimes in moments of turmoil and chaos in our life, that happens in recovery because it does. like I've had some moments of chaos in my life and my recovery and some other addictions with food and nicotine and, stuff like that. And so, working through my character defects and really deciding on what values do I want to possess? Like, what are the things that are most important to me? The hows of the program, being honest, open-minded, willing, being trustworthy, having integrity, you know, being genuine, believing in justice and believing in community. And so I created this list of values, of spiritual principles that were really important to me. And for me, it was always about checking in with myself. Is this feeding my recovery? Is this feeding my addiction? You know, and that was how I lived my life. And if it was feeding my addiction, then I would talk about it, because keeping a secret, like I had kept secrets my entire life. And so so I really had to learn how to do that different. And so I went to school and I became a substance abuse counselor. And I've been doing that for 22 years. I started working pretty much, I think I had about 15 months when I started working in the field. And, I just feel like when I look back sometimes at the life that I grew up in, I'm really amazed that we even survived. Like, I just don't know how we would survive that. And, I could go into tell you guys crazy stories like all of us have, but really my process of recovery has been just that two steps forward and one step back, right? And that, and not holding myself to that place of perfection. The one thing I do hold myself to that place of perfection with is being honest. Like, I know that for me, that if I start lying, then I'm in relapse mode. Right. And so I really monitor those things all the time. And I'm always telling on myself. And if I feel like I want to hide something, I know I need to share it, because then it creates shame if I hide it. And so so I'm going to go up to 10, 11 and 12, because I really believe in living those steps, 10, 11 and 12. And so when I got to step 12, I thought, OK, I'm going to try to find a God. Like, I'm going to try to find a God. I'm going to put the effort in to do that. So I went to Buddhism and the 12 steps. I went to Wellbriety, which is the Native American 12 steps. And I started going to the Sweat Lodge, and I started doing the lodge, and I started getting into Indian dancing again, which is something I had done as a child. And the only thing I didn't do was go to a church. But I was trying to like find some kind of a spiritual connection. And so really for me, I still really feel like I am atheist, right? And I share that because I want you to know that people can stay clean and be atheist. Like, you, as long as, at least for me, as long as I'm aligned with my values and I have beliefs and I'm practicing those, then I am walking a spiritual path. And that's how, and the group, the power greater than myself is this group, right? This group is more powerful than I could ever be. And if it wasn't for this group, I would not be sitting here today, because you guys like showed me like how to live, like how to be human and how to not be so rough, because I was rough. Like, I was just a rough person. And I'm 100% softer now than I was, but trust me, I'm still not as soft as sometimes I could still be pretty rough. And I know my significant other can attest to that. And I have to watch myself sometimes, because sometimes I get to that place of like, God, just quit being a baby, you know, like, not to him, but just sometimes I feel that way in my head. I'm like, God, this, you know, but anyways, so, I don't know how much time I have left. So if you're sitting here and you're struggling with the higher power thing, it's like, it doesn't have to be perfect, right? Nothing has to be perfect. But what does have to be is that we don't put something in our body. And that's been like, for me, it's like, no matter what, don't put something in my body. Like, I am not under any illusion that I can, you know, use a line of cocaine in the future or drink some alcohol or do drugs. You know, I just know that that is not something that I can do, because I won't stop. And so I quit smoking January 29th, my sobriety birthday. I made the decision to quit smoking on my sobriety birthday. And I'm telling you, I feel like a newcomer like all the time. It's so hard, right? And I struggle with it every day. And, you know, I engaged in addictive behaviors around it, like hiding it from my significant other because I told him I quit, and then I started smoking again, and so now I'm hiding it, and I'm washing my hands, and I'm brushing my teeth so he didn't smell it. You know, all that addict stuff that comes out, you know, all those character defects of hiding it. And so it is a struggle to not smoke, but I also know that if I smoke one puff, that I will start smoking again. And so I just really try to apply that. If you didn't hear something that you needed to hear, stick around and you'll hear something. Eventually you'll hear something that you can relate to, and you'll probably hear your story. And anyways, that's it. Thanks. Hopefully I didn't shut this off. Oh, there we go.